The year is 1971, in the dog days of summer. The place is Madawaska, Maine, just this side of the U.S.-Canadian border.
Once you travel north, you'd see the French-Acadian mindset. We are the other Maine.
There are uprisings and protests going on all over the world, and this town has had its own conflict brewing for years.
I remember an employee saying to me, if I was English, I could have your job.
That August, it turned into something else.
We started watching these guys coming at us in formation, dressed in the riot gear.
Things erupted. We stood there wondering how the hell we were going to get out of there.
I think it's part of our culture. Either you fight or you lose.
Today, we present the story of how a small community, united by their heritage and their livelihood, took on the town's largest employer and the state police. The story of the strike at Fraser Paper. Madawaska is a manufacturing town in the northernmost tip of Maine, the largest community in the area known as the Upper St. John Valley. It was settled in 1785 by 16 Acadian families who had escaped deportation from Acadie, now known as Nova Scotia, a generation before. Kim Ouellette grew up there nearly two centuries later.
It's beautiful, very rural, somewhat secluded.
Even after all these years, the community's identity remains connected to its Acadian roots.
My first language was French. I learned how to speak English by watching Sesame Street. Seriously.
Richard Marston moved to Madawaska in the mid-60s. The valley wasn't like other places he had lived.
If you went into a restaurant, people spoke to you first in French. And when they found out that you didn't speak French, they would switch to English.
Madawaskan culture can be distilled to three main traits: the French language, the Catholic faith, and a fundamental sense of togetherness.
You work hard, you contribute to the community, you participate.
There were large families here. I remember families of 24 children with no twins.
Everybody played with each other. Everybody knew each other's business. I mean, that whole area is just a large extended family.
It's a family that's been made closer by a discrimination that goes back to the beginning.
A lot of people from Madawaska identify themselves as Acadians.
Lise Pelletier is the director of the Acadian Archives at the University of Maine at Fort Kent.
And when I'd say, well, what does that mean for you? People from whatever generation would say, our ancestors were kicked out by the British. And this fact that they were sure of was not taught in the schools. This is what their families told their children.
Many French-speaking Canadians moved to Maine during the Industrial Revolution to work in mills and factories.
The number of French workers was seen as a menace. The industrialists felt threatened. What if some hothead started talking about work conditions? The authority could be reversed or removed. That was enough to start a campaign in the newspapers that they want to destroy our Protestant way of life. The stereotypes were the French were stupid because they didn't speak English. They had to be oversexed because they had so many kids. And they were a little bit crazy because they believed in the Pope being an infallible person.
Anti-French propaganda was part of a general climate of xenophobia. The Ku Klux Klan had gained great influence in Maine. And in 1919, they pushed through legislation that forbade the speaking of any language but English in Maine schools.
There was a lot of discrimination against French people. In fact, when I was in grade school, we could not speak French in school. That was voodoo.
Like many of Madawaska's current residents, Paul Sear remembers a common childhood scene.
At recess, when you're playing and you're a kid, you're going to revert to your natural language, and we'd get caught in the schoolyard speaking French, and the nuns would take us inside and wrap our fingers with the big ruler, and if you got caught several times, they'd wash your mouth out with soap.
Former State Senator Judy Parody is a lifelong St. John Valley resident.
Children would start kindergarten monolingual French, and they would have to eliminate it. So we didn't know the difference between, you don't like my language, you don't like my face, you don't like me. How could you, a child, separate that?
It was insinuated. If you speak French, you're going to be stupid the rest of your life.
When they were punishing children for speaking French, it was mostly the boys. And I used to think, silly them. We, the girls, spoke all the French we wanted, but they never caught us. I was judging them to be not very bright, not to be able to get away with this, you know. And then I realized they were rebelling. When you start working when you're 9, 10 years old in the fields, you acquire some confidence in yourself. And so I think now I realize that that's what they were doing. They were not going to take this.
Maine's Franco-American workers, though they were looked down upon by many English speakers, were essential to the state's major industries, especially paper. When three Scottish brothers named Fraser built a paper mill in Madawaska in 1925, they found a strong and able workforce in the local French population. For the farmers of the Upper St. John Valley, this was a tantalizing opportunity to attain a steady middle-class livelihood, and many of them decided to do so. By the time Dan Daigle was a Fraser employee in the 1960s...
They employed at least half of the town's people. If you wanted to stay local, it was kind of like an accepted way of life. The wages were good, the benefits were good. You get into the mill, and you're all set for life.
Fraser was the heart of the town.
Dan's wife, Debbie.
There was nothing else really as far as financially. I mean, you know, it was a lifeblood.
Although many families still maintained small farms, Madawaska was no longer a farming town. The way of life had been transformed.
8-hour shifts, punch out, stop at the bar for a couple beers, and then go home. It was mill town mentality, mill town activity, mill town.
Fraser's facilities spanned both sides of the border. The plant on the Canadian side turned lumber into pulp, which they pumped across the border to Madawaska, where it was transformed into a variety of papers by workers like Jerry Sear.
We made Bible paper, we made Telco, Sears Directory.
Richard Marston worked in Fraser's Human Resources Department starting in the mid-60s.
Catalog paper was good business in those days. Everybody that was in it was making money. Pennies, S&H food stamps. We were making paper for the filters on cigarettes, the brown paper. And in those days, it had white spots for whatever reason. We were trying to get those white spots in that brown paper.
It was like many of the incredible mills in Maine that made Maine like the Detroit of paper in the mid-20th century. It was the biggest paper-producing state, and they made the most elegant, kind of high-end papers.
Michael Hillard is an economics professor at the University of Southern Maine who has studied the Maine paper industry. He conducted many of the interviews heard in this program for his research.
In the period after World War II up into the 1970s, it was an economic situation that manufacturers longed for. There was more demand for the paper than supply at almost all times.
In this era, jobs at Fraser were generally secure, though they weren't always comfortable.
It was always hot in the steam plant anyway, summer, winter, spring, or fall. Over 100 degrees and lots of humidity. And on the paper machines, if you had to go under the hoods, passing the sheet, you're in 130, 140 degree heat.
Beyond the unpleasant atmosphere, mill work could be truly dangerous. Paul Shear worked at Fraser during the 1970s.
Walking into a paper mill, you walk into a chemical soup in terms of the atmosphere that you're breathing. People breathe that over a lifetime, and very few people, at least in the 70s and the 80s, nobody lived to retire out of a paper mill in this state. I shouldn't say nobody, there are people that made it, but the vast majority did not.
In addition to the chemicals, the noise, the heat, and the huge machines that could crush a man's arm between giant rollers, there was a stress of an inconsistent work schedule.
We'd work 7 days, 12 to 8, 2 days off, 7 days 4-to-12 shift, 1 day off, 7 days day shift, 4 days off. You just kept rotating like that. The hardest part was the 12-to-8 shift. I had a hard time sleeping in the daytime. It would mess up your eating habits, your digestive system.
In exchange for their sacrifices, Fraser workers enjoyed steady, lifelong employment. The company maintained state-of-the-art research and development laboratories that steadily introduced new types of paper. Company salesmen fanned across the country, pulling in customers from many industries. The unionized workers were compensated as well as those in any industry in the state. Mike Walsh worked in human resources at Fraser Paper for 20 years.
At the time I was there, we were rocking. Because at the time, they reinvested in the equipment. And we had, although sometimes contentious relationships with the unions, we were able to negotiate successful contracts.
In the mid-60s, the biggest American corporations were in the midst of a merger craze, seeking an elusive magic called synergy. For larger companies like International Paper, Scott Paper, and Georgia Pacific, this meant buying up smaller companies like Fraser and putting their mills through a process called rationalization. Investment in new technology and the arrival of new managers armed with the latest efficiency strategies was considered a surefire way to whip these smaller mills into shape, pushing their profitability to new heights.
La rationalization, I have problems saying that word in English.
Historian Nicole Long.
When you read the minutes of the meetings of the board of directors and the executive committee, you feel that they're really nervous. They believe that Fraser had to become more competitive so that the shareholders remain faithful to the Fraser Companies Limited. They had to make technological changes to be more efficient. They felt also that they had to cut the number of workers. And they felt they had no choice because they could not remain independent if they did not move on this.
So in 1968, Fraser's board voted to rationalize the company themselves instead of letting some larger corporation swoop in and do it for them. They hired a tough set of managers from a rival company, Great Northern Paper, to come in and modernize the Madawaska mill from the ground up. The new company president was the hard-charging John Hoyer.
He was a real action guy. He made things happen, and he made things happen rapidly, right? And so he would ruffle a lot of feathers.
This is Peter Egan, whose father worked with Hoyer at Great Northern Paper.
You know, my father and Hoyer drank and smoked. Hoyer drank whiskey and smoked 10 cigarettes in 5 minutes, and my father would drink a martini and smoke 3 cigarettes in 5 minutes. Hoyer was absolutely a guy that they would all follow into battle.
Hoyer's arrival coincided with the 1968 negotiation of the mill's union contracts. Hoyer made the case that Fraser was facing a moment of crisis, and he succeeded in persuading the unions to accept the change that they'd been resisting for years. Richard Marston.
In those days, Sunday was a very sacred thing for the folks here, the Acadian people. So the mill was not operating on a 7-day schedule.
In that contract, finally, they said yes to Sunday work. And you have to remember that the majority of the workers are French and are Catholics. For them, it was a really big concession. The company then promised, if they made that concession, that it would create new jobs.
The parts of the contract that ensured these new jobs were called the Manning Letters. Michael Hillard again.
What the Manning Letters did was to specify how many workers would be needed for a specific process. Hoyer had built $60 million of new machines, telling the workers that our part is asking you to give us these breaks so that we can restore profitability. What we will provide for you is hundreds of new jobs to go along with the expansion. So that's the significance of the Manning Letters.
With the new contract signed, Hoyer began his overhaul, a plan he dubbed the Big Thrust. The man to enact it was his new production manager, Marty Roach.
He used to go around the mill with a stopwatch, and he used to time the workers to see the time for each task that was made. It's as if they were under a microscope, huh? And they were really being watched all the time. That's why they called him the cockroach. Coquerelle, it's an insect that you want to get rid of. And when they saw him coming, the workers told me that they became a bit aggressive towards him because they knew that what that guy was trying to do is find ways to cut jobs.
The big thrush challenged the way Fraser's papermakers had been doing their jobs, some of them for decades. It bothered them that the new managers were looking over their shoulders rather than talking to them face to face. Workers Dan Daigle and Jerry Shear.
In the paper industry, there is nothing like experience. Prior to the days where the paper machines were computer controlled, these men were going just by the feel, the sound, the touch. It was really mind-boggling to watch some of these men work.
As you make your rounds on a paper machine, you're listening to motors, you're listening to pumps. If there's a vibration in the pump, you'll hear it. If there's a motor whining, you'll hear it.
An experienced machine tender would tell us, I'm going to make such and such an adjustment, and this figure should jump from here to there. And on the following reel of paper, he was dead on to what he had told you.
Let me put it this way. You're not going to take somebody on the street and put him up there for 2 weeks to make a paper maker out of it.
But as the management style changed, they had a mindset that if you had a college degree, you didn't have to know the job to be a manager. When they started preaching this to us, I told the guys, I smell a rat. And it is absolutely impossible for these guys to come out of school and show you boys how to make paper.
The senior managers were very difficult to deal with. They were very command and control oriented. They were not used to having to sit down and talk over issues. They were used to, this is the way you're going to do it. And, you know, it was more, they were in control.
See, Hoyer had a kind of a short fuse. And I think this was a strategy that he used, to be honest with you. So he would go in and just get everybody kerflummoxed. He wanted to make it clear that there wasn't going to be any questioning and there wasn't going to be any messing around. If he went in and said, okay, we're doing this, and there was somebody raised an eyebrow, that wasn't going to work. No, don't raise your eyebrows. I just think Hoyer just had a vision, and he didn't need any naysayers, and he would crush the opposition.
Papermaker Lucian Mazarol.
At that time, the atmosphere started changing because there was a feeling amongst the worker that these two individuals coming from another town were not up here to look after the best interests of the people. And that really starts some kind of animosity and hard feeling between workers and management.
There's an expression in French, we say une atmosphère à couper au couteau. It means that the atmosphere is so dense that you could take a knife and slice it in two. And the workers use that expression with me. And it tells it all. It was really a stressful time at the mill because the workers didn't know what would happen in the near future.
The big thrust had stirred up feelings in the Fraser workforce that went beyond the frustration of an outsider telling you how to do your job. There was also the sense that this lack of respect was about who they were.
In those days, all of the management people were English-speaking people.
Richard Marston was one of those English speakers. He worked in human resources.
There was almost no one in the management group that had a Franco-American background.
The mill opened in 1925. From the start, it was clear that management jobs, good-paying jobs, specialized jobs, were given to the English, people who came from outside the region. And the low-paying jobs, the labor jobs, jobs that were less interesting but were harder physically, were given to the French.
And there was actually an English section of town, bungalows that were located near the mill. Those tended to be supervisory people that lived in those.
They did not mix with the population. They sent their kids to English school. They went to different churches. Very few families mixed, and even talked. It was kind of two societies having parallel lives. All these managers, all these guys who were engineers, who had jobs in the laboratory, once they retired, they left town. It was not their community. I think it helps us understand why some of them really never got it and really had problems negotiating with the workers.
Lise Peltier.
It was a love-hate relationship because the mill is both the savior and also the oppressor. It provides good money and income, but it also rules your life.
We all knew the leadership that we had there, which we're talking the upper up, did not respect French people.
Papermaker Ron Albert.
Hoyer and those people, yeah. The less we give those Frenchmen, the more money we make. And they're stupid, they'll do it. I've seen a boss there actually kick a guy in the butt because he wasn't moving fast enough. How much can you take of that?
Coming up, the tension at Madawaska's Fraser Mill reaches its breaking point. After this.
Tensions at Fraser Paper grew steadily in the period after the 1968 contract. The unions had agreed to work longer hours, including Sundays, in exchange for assurances in the form of Manning letters that more paper coming out of the mill would translate to more jobs. For a community that thought of itself as one big extended family, the Manning letters were critically important. Historian Nicole Long.
Those new jobs were never created. And what's worse in 1970 is that they had started cutting back jobs. More than 70 jobs had been lost. The workers feel that the company is not respecting a contract. And they feel that they are being played here.
In June 1971, union leaders met management to negotiate a new contract. They found that Hoyer and his team were still not interested in following the Manning letters, and in fact wanted to eliminate them altogether.
I think management, they had this mentality of wanting to take on the union. There was friction in the good old days, but it was productive.
People just need to be treated with dignity and respect, and if everybody was treated with dignity and respect, and you did not have corporate people that were totally greedy and one-sided, you wouldn't need unions.
If you're making them money, you know, the money should be there to support the worker, you know, because they get rich by the workers. That's how it works.
If one side or the other perceives that they have more power than the other side, and that balance of power gets used, the strike usually results.
That's usually what happens when people are oppressed. When they've had enough, they rebel.
Management was pushing, and we were being pushed against the wall, so we just walked out. Everybody out. Picket and everything. We just closed the mill down.
Hey,
The nearly 1,000 unionized employees set up headquarters at the local Knights of Columbus Hall and began a 24/7 picket line. There were four unions at Fraser, Locals 247 and 252 of the United Papermakers and Paperworkers, Local 365 of the International Brotherhood of Pulp, Sulfite, and Paper Mill Workers, and Local 232 of the Office and Professional Employees International Union. All four had voted to go on strike, effective at noon Friday, July 9th, 1971. The local newspaper, the St. John Valley Times, became one of the only lines of communication between unions and management throughout the strike. In addition to daily front-page coverage of the latest developments, the paper agreed to publish statements by both union and mill leadership at no cost. A war of words ensued.
The company does not want a strike and regrets the inconvenience and hardships this will bring to our employees and the communities. When the strike is over, we will have the difficult job of winning back our customers.
They are now trying to make us believe that this strike is causing them to lose their customers when other companies are filling out their orders for them with an understanding that when things get back to normal, Fraser takes their customers back.
Fraser insisted that if they gave the unions what they wanted, the mill's very existence would be threatened. And their shipping partners, led by the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad, sent their own letter to the paper, pleading to readers that the strike could destroy all their livelihoods.
Who wins if Fraser loses? Not the happiest thought, but have you considered it? What could replace paper in northern Maine? Sugar beets haven't yet proven to be the answer, and Maine potatoes are having a time of it, too.
The unions said the biggest issue was not money, but what they called a morale problem.
The morale problem started when management saw fit to do the reverse of what had been proposed by the company in 1968 in order for them to influence the people to accept the 7-day operation schedule.
According to the unions, Fraser had increased automation, combined jobs, and worked them longer hours, which allowed the company to operate more paper machines without hiring more workers. All of the things that the Manning letters were supposed to prevent.
With this in mind, can you now visualize why the union people feel that these letters are so important to them? The company again this year says, "Come now, fellows, trust us. Have faith in us." We ask the company this, with its past practices, how can we trust you?
For the unions, the problem wasn't just that the Manning letters had been ignored, it was that ignoring the Manning letters exposed a deep disrespect.
How does a company who treats people like this even dare ask cooperation? The present management has never heard of human dignity, and it does not seem as if they want to learn. A strike may not have been the answer, but to keep working under such pressure and abuse is not the answer either.
Despite the lively back and forth in the newspaper, actual negotiations were still not taking place. And of course, neither was paper production.
They set up picket lines and pretty much nothing moved in and out of the mill, except for the management people.
All the businesses in town, they brought down sandwiches for the people, and the whole town was backing the workers.
Everybody was on pins and needles, because if there's no salary coming into the household, they're not going to be shopping.
I remember there was a place called Burt's Hot Dog Stand, who every day of the strike, I believe, would make a chicken stew, and he would bring it down to the picket lines and feed the workers.
There must have been a lot of chicken stew made, because the strike went on for days and then weeks. For workers, this took a major financial toll. They received weekly stipends from the union, which were only a small fraction of their usual pay, and some workers were forced to move away and find new jobs. After nearly a month of 24-hour picketing, there had still been no negotiations, and none were planned. On the morning of Thursday, August 5th, the front page of the St. John Valley Times read, "Fraser situation, just about the same. No settlement in sight." But the real news that day was back on page 7, where Fraser had printed a full-page ad that began with this provocative question.
What does it take to move a mountain? A mountain of paper, that is. Today, Fraser has a mountain of paper waiting to be moved to its customers.
Sometime shortly, this paper will be moved, and we hope with the cooperation of the strikers. Our customers need this paper. We fully intend to keep our customers happy.
Management seemed to think that announcing their intentions would ensure that workers stayed out of the way. This turned out to be a miscalculation. Worker Camille Bernier.
They were telling us exactly what they were going to do. People said, you're going to move a mountain over our dead body.
What does it take to move a mountain? Without major highway access in Madawaska, paper shipments were made by train. The Bangor and Aroostook Railroad operated a line which led directly to Fraser's warehouse. While workers had spent July picketing, managers had been inside, loading the white mountain of paper onto railroad cars. It filled 27 of them. For the strikers, the stakes were now clear. The fate of the shipment would determine the outcome of the strike. Ron Elber.
They were telling us that once these cars are loaded, they're going to move them out. The money to get of that, they could hold out the strike a lot longer. So the word got around, and the people said, there's no train leaving this property.
The plan to ship paper was not a complete surprise to the unions. In fact, they had inside information collected by wives of striking workers, some of whom worked in the management offices. So they'd already made a plan to block the railroad tracks with large pieces of pulpwood and their own bodies.
I remember I went to the front line where the diesel was, and there was a person for the B&A telling us to get out. We had no right to be there, and people were listening. We may have no right to be here, but you have no right to move this paper either.
Newspapers would estimate that 75 strikers gathered on the railroad tracks.
People were standing next to the diesel, and I heard the guy tell the diesel operator, push him out. So he started moving the diesel forward very slowly. And I saw a few people almost get their foot caught between the diesel and the track. And a lot of people were seeing that. So people started jumping onto the diesel. When he saw the people ganging up onto the diesel, he hightailed it out of there.
But Fraser and the B&A would not be deterred that easily. The next day, they sent another engine, only to meet even more strikers, around 200 this time. Once again, the engine, aided only by a few local police, was unable to reach the warehouse. Union member Real Daigle recalls that the strikers tried to keep the peace, telling the officers, don't bother us, and we ain't going to bother you. The strikers had won the first two battles, but Fraser President Pete Hoyer was not ready to back down. Strikers Paul and Jerry Sear.
The governor of the state of Maine, who was Ken Curtis at the time, ordered in the state police, and they basically took over the town. There were policemen on every street corner. They were everywhere.
Somebody saw them at the old drive-in that they were massing up and getting ready. They were going to come down and break up the mob, which was probably what they were calling us.
They didn't really declare martial law in that you couldn't go on the streets, but they were there, you know, physically present, intimidatory. It was an occupation.
If the strikers were intimidated, they didn't show it.
I remember riding through town and razzing the police on the street corners and just, you know, trying to give them a hard time. There was no violence, just verbal stuff.
The razzing turned out to be a distraction, intentional or not, from preparations being made elsewhere. The strikers had learned that B&A planned to show up Monday morning while the town was still asleep, in hopes of avoiding another blockade. Striker Bob Gogan.
They were coming in too early in the morning and everybody was sleeping, so we had to delay him. There was a crew that had some little covert operations going on. I was on back of the water district there. We took some rails out to like 3 o'clock in the morning. And they had to have a crew put the rails back in so that the train could pass, and that bought us some time.
The union leaders distanced themselves from that kind of activity because a lot of things that happened in retrospect probably were very illegal.
Former State Senator Judy Parody, whose father worked at the mill.
The brilliance of this, you know, these are little farm boys. They thought of everything.
By the time the train's crew had rebuilt the tracks, the sun was already rising, and the strikers were ready to begin the next phase of their operation. They were going to mobilize a much larger group of people to greet the train than they'd brought out on Thursday or Friday. To do this, they needed a signal. Dan Daigle.
The union men had set up somebody to ring the church bells, somebody to blow the horn and siren at the firehouse to alert the people that they were indeed moving the trains.
We passed the message around to all the families that if you hear an early morning blast, that means get your family on the tracks. Matter of fact, I was the one that would let the siren go. It was well planned. We were together, like a big team, you know.
It wasn't just the workers. It drew a whole bunch of other people down.
The whole town of Madawaska was standing on the railroad track, helping out the union members concerned about the job and the future of this town.
I often wonder if that isn't French mentality. We're going all together or we're not going at all. People up here, throughout the Acadian history, everything was family-oriented. Families worked together on the farms, from the grandfather down to the youngest child in the house. I think that the roots of it, the heritage of it, I don't know if it's in the genes or the culture, but it's like we're going to do what we have to do to stand our ground. This is our bread and butter, and we are not going to starve.
I think it was close to 1,000 people maybe that day on the railroad track and all around, everywhere on site.
The newspaper's estimate that the crowd numbered more than 300 people was more conservative. But even by the low estimates, the Madawaskans sitting on the narrow train tracks had the police outnumbered 10-1. Once again, they piled wood on the rails and stood together in the path of the locomotive.
We got down there, and it was quite a crowd of demonstrators.
State Trooper Jerry LaPointe was not expecting to encounter such a large group or such a diverse one.
Women and children, men, and we deployed to try to get them away from the train, but they put the children in the front ranks, women in the second rank, and the men behind them. And in theory was, they, you know, we're all family men, too, and you're not going to whack a little kid or a woman, bottom line. You know, so they took advantage of that weakness.
Dan Daigle was one of the men on the tracks.
I believe that the men figured if we have our wives and children sitting on the track, the train is going to stop. But if it's just a bunch of union men sitting on the track, management has so little respect for us, they're probably going to tell the train engineer, plow them over.
To me, that proves that there was never any intent to be violent. Never, never, because you never put your wife and children in harm's way.
But the state police had their orders. They were there to prevent the strikers from illegally blocking the paper shipment. So they reached into their arsenal of crowd control tactics. First, they tried to wedge their way through the crowd.
It's a wedge. Push down through. Split them up. You know, without anybody getting hurt. And that didn't work well. There was more of them than there was of us.
We started watching these guys coming at us in formation, dressed in kind of riot gear. They came up to the crowd, tried to disperse the people, and everybody just stayed put. Nobody moved.
At this point, the police made a decision that would change the nature of the day's encounter and of the entire strike.
They fired tear gas, you know, the typical riot control stuff. As soon as they fired the tear gas, that's when the riot started.
The state police opened up the tear gas, but the winds were blowing from the east, and the tear gas was blowing back into their face, so the crowd never got any tear gas. So that didn't work. What they started doing was shooting tear gas canisters right over the heads of the people, and they would come right down into the middle of the crowd. At that point, people started getting a little bit pissed off, so everybody picked up rocks that were lying on the side of the rails, and everybody started to throw rocks. I could remember a black cloud of rocks, and I'm guilty for throwing a few myself.
Trooper LaPointe remembers what went through his mind.
Oh, my Jesus. You have a moment with them right then and there. Geez, they were winding them to you. I mean, it's almost like an eclipse out there. The sky was so full of rocks.
Debbie Daigle was one of the children there.
I was about 11 or 12, and I really didn't understand what was going on. It was like a mini riot. I know I did throw some rocks, and I was a tomboy, and I had a good arm, and I kind of think I did cut someone in the face.
Those rocks down there, those tracks, pretty sharp. Some of your clothing would get shredded and you'd get cut up in your arms, but nothing serious. You know. We got separated from the main body and got crowded in between two railroad cars. And then the crowd really kept chanting and screaming. And we stood there wondering how the hell we were going to get out of there. After a while, we watched them, and I told them, I said, they don't even know we're here anymore. We took our helmets off. We walked right through the crowd, and they never saw us. We got on the other side of it to get to safety. Took advantage of that mob mentality rule at that point.
Some strikers, feeling like they now had the upper hand, released their frustrations on the locomotives and the police cars.
A whole bunch of cars got turned upside down, and the state troopers were just running away because they were scared for their life.
Everybody started running to the place where the squad cars were parked. And I can still, to this day, remember three state troopers sitting in a squad car. The guy that was driving hadn't gotten there. And there was a four-foot pulpwood in between the troopers in the back seat of the car.
They literally demolished two state police cruisers. And they totally demolished the locomotive of the train.
They never thought they were going to meet a whole bunch of people like that at the time. They were not ready for the number of people that was on site. So they had to just run away and leave the car there.
In a matter of minutes, the situation had transformed from a peaceful standoff to one of the largest violent confrontations between civilians and police in Maine's history. Word soon reached the governor's office in Augusta that the Madawaska powder keg had exploded. Dan Daigle.
The governor, Kenneth Curtis, right away he placed a phone call into the state police and told these boys, get out of there before somebody dies.
Trooper Jerry LaPointe remembers tempers cooling off almost as quickly as they had ignited.
The local people thought that enough was enough. And nobody wanted anybody to get hurt. So they de-escalated, and everybody moved out and caught a breath. And we were put on different posts around the area. And wherever one of us was, it would be one of the, I guess a striker, for lack of a better term, would be with you. And we would shake hands, hey, my name's Jerry, my name's Bob. And we'd just converse like a couple of guys.
In addition to calling off the state troopers, Governor Curtis decided to assess the situation in person. Neil Rold was his chief aide at the time.
The governor, he stuck his head in my office and said, we're going up to Madawaska.
The scene that awaited them was not pretty. Phil Dubois.
The rail cars were basically demolished. They left squad cars there and cars were overturned, all the windows broken.
As bad as the violence was, Bangor Daily News reported the next day that there were no serious injuries, though there wasn't a trooper without rock-sized bruises. Amazingly, throughout all three attempts to ship the paper, not a single arrest was made. Paul Shear.
It could have been a lot worse than what it was. There were guns involved on both sides. I know that there were state police sharpshooters on the roof of the mill. My understanding was that even if the railroad had left with the boxcars, they would not have made it out of town. There were allegedly explosives planted. It could have been really, really bad.
I don't think that the management group and I don't think that the law enforcement realized the animosity that was built up in these people.
Dan Daigle.
That they were willing to risk anything and everything. They anticipated this strike coming for a long time. They got prepared for it, and they meant business.
That afternoon, Fraser released a statement signed by John Hoyer.
Fraser Management has attempted to save customers and jobs in making this shipment of paper, but chooses not to risk serious injury to members of the community.
When this message was broadcast over the radio late Monday afternoon, the remaining strikers began to disperse. Fraser would make no further attempts to ship the paper. State police returned the next day to retrieve the truck and the two cruisers, one overturned, that they had left at the scene of the riot.
They stopped at my dad's store to get a soda to drink and everything. One of the state troopers, my dad asked him, says, "So, all your fun over and done with over here, or what?" And the guy opened his shirt, and right here next to the collar, he had a nice big blue mark. I'm assuming one of the rocks hit its mark. And I remember this statement very well. He says, "I've never seen Madawaska. I hope I never see Madawaska again."
Governor Curtis arrived Monday evening, determined to restart the negotiations that had been stalled for over a month. Neil Rowland.
I remember we met in a high school, and the management was in one classroom and the workers were the other. But we were met first by the workers, if I remember, and very fired up. I mean, these were very hot-headed people, and Ken was trying to calm them down. And on the other side, it was just the same. You know, when are you going to call in the National Guard and start shooting these people? That was hyperbole, but that was almost the way they were talking about it. There was one guy, I can't remember his name, and he was a loudmouth son of a gun. And he was, you know, "You got to stomp on these people and you got to, you know, force them to do what we want." And there was an arrogance among those kinds of people that was just beyond belief.
Unsurprisingly, negotiations didn't take off immediately. And when the next contract offer was put in front of the workers, the four locals rejected it by an overwhelming 591-48 margin.
Our paychecks were higher.
Talks could have gone on much longer, but the process was accelerated by outside circumstances.
The time has come for decisive action. Action that will break the vicious circle of spiraling prices and costs.
President Nixon addressed the nation on August 15, 1971.
"I am today ordering a freeze on all prices and wages throughout the United States for a period of 90 days.
Although there was no indication that Nixon was aware of the Fraser strike, his historic wage and price freeze, designed to slow inflation, had the side effect of taking further wage increases off the table. The eventual contract included a raise that was just 5 cents more than what Fraser had offered at the beginning of negotiations more than 4 months earlier. Paul Scheer.
So essentially what the company did, if I recall right, they offered us a nickel to come back to work. And given the writing on the wall, people went back to work, and that was the end of the strike. When we went back to work, again, it was with a very bitter taste in the mouths of the workers.
But there were reasons to see the outcome as a win for the unions. For one, they held on to the Manning letters and had reason to expect that this time they would be respected because Pete Hoyer and Marty Roach were gone. Michael Hillard.
What in the end sunk Hoyer and the people that he brought in from Great Northern Paper was overplaying their hand in thinking that they could get the unions to accept whatever they would want, and that turned out not to be the case. The strike was very costly, an estimated $4 million in lost profits, And based on that, the shareholders of the firm decided that it was time for him to go.
I think after that, we started getting better contracts. So I think that maybe that was one of the turning points for Fraser, because, I mean, when we said we weren't happy with their conditions, we were listened to, which I think was, a move forward. A very bad experience, but not a bad result from it.
In the aftermath of the strike, Fraser's owners took steps that would begin to heal the rift over language and culture that had dated from the mill's founding. Within a few years, Fraser hired Bill Lafanaboise, a French speaker, to be mill manager. Such a hiring would have been unheard of before the strike, and he became one of Fraser's most popular managers, a bridge between the mill and its workers.
Didn't get 100% what we wanted. Monetary-wise, we didn't get much, but we got the respect that the people needed in that mill.
The period following the Fraser strike coincided with a worldwide resurgence of interest in the Cajun diaspora. Lise Peltier.
Let's say since 1970, there's been a huge explosion of recognition and embracing this Acadian identity, and it has been manifested in literature, arts, research.
In the Upper St. John Valley, this could be seen in a number of new organizations with an historical focus. Judy Parody.
That's when it started in the 70s, early 70s. Now every community has a historical society, and the promouvoir la langue, la culture, for the keep the language and the culture.
A central piece of this mission is Madawaska's annual Acadian Festival, now in its 39th year, which always features a reunion for one of the valley's several large Acadian families.
Every year, a different family is chosen. The name of the family might not appear on a list of names from Acadia in 1755, but the word Acadian has come to mean the French-speaking people in the St. John Valley. They are still called an Acadian family and celebrated as such.
Perhaps there is a connection between the remarkable uprising of Madawaska's French paper workers and the resurgence of cultural pride in the valley.
It probably was the first time we'd flexed our muscles and had felt that we'd proven our point. And I do believe that it made us appreciate who we were, some of the qualities we had.
Dawn Scheer is the president of the Musée Culturel du Mont Carmel in Lille, just a few miles down Route 1 from the mill. The museum is housed in an early 20th century church whose congregation once included many Fraser workers and their families.
In 1973, they put the church in St. David and the church here in Lille on the National Register of Historic Places. So I think there was more of an awareness of how our history needed to be woven into the fabric of the history of the state of Maine, because we tend to be ignored up here when you talk about Maine history. I think with the Fraser strike, there was a sense of empowerment. A grassroots movement accomplished something. And if they could accomplish that economically, what could we accomplish if we worked together culturally?
Madawaskan Rebellion was produced by Gabe Graben and Michael Hillard, with assistance from Shay Shackelford. Narration by Berman Banville. Additional voicing by Dan Béchard and Paul Beaver. Thanks to Sheila Jans, Guy Dubay, Lise Peltier, and everyone who shared their stories with us. This program was made possible by support from the Maine Humanities Council and the University of Maine at Fort Kent, and is dedicated to the memory of Bob Gogan.
As a matter of fact, I was the one that let the siren go.